From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack, and thanks as always for joining us on this look back at connections from the week. And we'll start the week with Hollywood coming to Rochester. The director of a new film called Chappaquiddick is a native of Pittsburgh, and he still lives in the Rochester area. John Curran was our guest, and he talked about the responsibility of doing a film on such a controversial subject. You probably know the outline of what happened at Chappaquiddick in 1969. Senator Ted Kennedy crashed his car off a wooden bridge, leading to the death of 28-year-old Mary Jo Kopechne. The new film examines the many layers of how Kennedy and his team handled the incident. Curran told us that he's a Democrat and a lifelong fan of Ted Kennedy's politics. And that's why he says it was even more important that he take on this subject.
Well, there's never been a film about this. And I would say right now, in this political climate, this is very much a time to re-examine something that's never really been examined properly. And I think that comment is how I felt. You know, when the script was sent to me, I thought, oh, Chappaquiddick, you know, like, I'm not sure I want to be a part of this. Because I knew that there's no good way of telling this story. You know, there's no positive version of it that helps Ted Kennedy. So yeah, it is opening an old wound. But I would say that it's coming out at a time where there feels like there's a lot more courage about reexamining these things honestly, and they need to be reexamined honestly.
In some ways, this is a statement about political tribalism. And would you like to see people of all political stripes be willing to reexamine things? So.
Yeah, I mean, I it seems bizarre to me that, you know, an accident that happened 50 years ago, and Teddy has been dead now for
almost 10
years, yeah. that we still have comments like that, that it's such a it's so sensitive and raw, such a raw nerve. As a director, how can I not do that film if it provokes that kind of an emotional response, you know? But, it's certainly, to me, you know, and I've had people on both sides of the aisle see the film, and so I'm very confident in saying that it is a balanced view of this accident. It isn't a one-dimensional hit piece. And, you know, I am left-leaning, and I do expect my friends on the right to be taking a hard look at their candidate and the obvious flaws that I see. I think we have to be the same with our own heroes and candidates.
Well, I mentioned that I think the conscience of this film is Ed Helms. Ed Helms is someone that listeners will know from mostly comedic roles, whether it's Hangover, The Office, many others. But I don't want to sell him short because, number one, his dramatic performance in this, I mean, this is an Oscar worthy supporting
role.
He's
very good, yeah.
He is fabulous. Tell the listeners who he plays in this.
He plays Joe Gargan, who is Teddy's cousin. And Joe Gargan and Ann Gargan, their mother was Rose Kennedy's sister. And both of their parents died when they were young. And Joe Kennedy essentially adopted Joe Gargan, which is, you know, a wonderful thing to do. Joey essentially became Teddy's sort of, because Teddy was the youngest, he sort of kept an eye on Teddy and became ultimately his fix-it guy, the guy, his advanced man, so to speak. But Joey was also an accomplished lawyer in his own right. Joey, after this incident, was somewhat disgusted with the whole affair and eventually became estranged from the Kennedy family in around like 72, something like that.
And there are several scenes, and I want to listen to one right now if we could. This is, the incident has happened, and at this point in the film, there is a discussion that Ted Kennedy is having with a number of people close to him about essentially how can he move forward? What kind of statement could he put out? What could he do in regards to the death of Mary Jo Kopechne that would allow him to preserve his potential presidential ambitions, his future career? And they're working on that. So you're going to hear first the voice of Jason Clark, who plays Ted Kennedy. You'll hear some interaction with some of the other people in the room with him. And then the scene concludes with Ed Helms as Joe Gargan interjecting. Let's listen.
This country has a deep connection to the Kennedy name, and that is a valuable thing, gentlemen. We can't just let that go to waste.
We need to remind the American people what this family has been through and how much more we have left to achieve.
And how are you planning on doing that, Ted?
A nationally televised statement. All three networks, prime time.
Is that all? Why not have Ted fill in for Carson on The Tonight Show?
That's actually not a bad idea. The networks will donate the time if it's part of their news coverage.
We could frame the national conversation the way we want it framed.
Then how do we do that?
He's got to look sympathetic.
It'd be easier to get him to fill in for Carson.
We tell the truth, or at least our version of it. And it ends with an appeal to the voters, to the people that elected me. We need to remind them that this family perseveres, that we don't back down from a fight, that we don't get backed into a corner. We have a true compass and we follow it. Now, I followed mine the best I could that night. And me and Paul and Joe, we did everything we could to save that poor girl.
You got a winner there, son.
Amen to that, yes.
Son of a bitch, that's a hell of a winner.
Not bad at all.
We get Swanson's Christmas speech up and down. Hell, if we do this right, he might be more electable.
That's good.
A girl dies, and yet somehow Ted is the martyr? Think about it. We really want to prop him up as an injured hero here?
As Joe Gargan, and that is an amazing scene to me, because what we see from there to the rest of the movie is what leads up to the speech, the roughly 11-minute speech that the nation saw.
Mm-hmm.
What did you want viewers to take from that scene, John?
It's really the beginning, you know, in the context of the film, I would say it's the first scene where Teddy takes some kind of control. He almost gets reduced to this kind of infantile state, returning back to his home. And, you know, his father has gathered a brain trust of Kennedy men, you know, and they literally just take over and start determining, you know, with their connections and whatnot, how to handle this. This scene's really Teddy putting himself forward and then Joey calling him into check.
Next, on the subject of politics, is this the most uncivil time in American political history? Carolyn Lukensmeyer is the director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and she says that Americans want more civility and fewer negative ads. But what exactly does that mean? Here's her answer.
I would say there's two categories of negative campaigning, one of which we would see as acceptable, and one of which we would see as unacceptable in civil politics. If we're running against each other and you've got a voting record that I know doesn't resonate with constituents that we're both after their votes, that's a negative ad. I'm going to run, you did X, Y, and Z, and I believe the constituents. But that's a fact. You actually did that.
Yeah.
The kind of negative campaigning was, and, you know, let's just think again back to the presidential, Crooked Hillary, Little Markle. I mean, just tons and tons of examples of no content whatsoever other than attack on the person. And we've actually also been talking to some political consultants, and they mirror what the public tells us. They're very worried that 2018 will be uglier than 2016. And consultants say, we saw what worked in 2016. It probably will be uglier than 2018 probably will be uglier. So back to your original question. Mm-hmm. What would a civil politics look like? A civil politics would try to stay in the legitimate use of data that fits your actual, what you actually did. And I can rate you as negative on your behavior rather than trying to attack you on your character. A civil politics would respect that we have an ideological spectrum about beliefs on issues because we really have those differences. But to move the society forward in a current time frame, compromise is the essence of politics. That's even something that people who are supporting incivility would say compromise is a dirty word. So a civil politics would respect what has always been treated as core, which is our differences have to come to a point of decision, which seems to represent the most common good, the most inclusive decision at this moment in time. Maybe that will shift later. So the principles would be no character assassination, a belief that we really have to have enough relationships across the aisle, that we can solve problems together that are really negatively impacting the American economy, the American public. You know, part of what I'll talk about tonight, our Congress hasn't worked the way Congress was intended to work in almost two decades. Regular order which is the process by which budgets are passed, has not operated for more than a decade. Most Americans don't even actually understand this. We have not had a formal U.S. budget for the next year for 13 or 14 years, which means Congress and federal agencies are all wrapped up in what they call continuing resolutions. Managers in agencies have to redo a budget every 4 or every 6 weeks. Imagine the human capacity that eats up. So a civil politics would hold the target that our job is to represent the American public, to solve the most incredible issues facing the nation. Sometimes we'll win on our side, sometimes we'll lose on our side, but we would not take the position that all we care about is ensuring that you lose. And that's how it's operating today.
Now, I can't help but think of a conversation we had yesterday on this program. The director of a new film that's coming out nationally on Friday called Chappaquiddick. And for years, Republicans, when Ted Kennedy would run for re-election in the Senate or float the idea of a presidential campaign, Republicans would say Chappaquiddick, Chappaquiddick. And I do not want to speak monolithically because we heard from a variety of opinions from the political left yesterday. But some Democrats would say that's just character assassination. That's not fair. That's not Ted Kennedy's governing record, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't go to jail. Well, number one, the movies reminded us that most people would have gone to jail if they weren't a senator and that he probably should have gone to jail. But he didn't go to jail. And so is it legitimate for his opponents to say in future years, look, look what happened here. I know it's not related to his governing, but I'm sorry. Or is Chappaquiddick out of bounds?
Well, it's very interesting, that example, because part of the way it was used really early on probably was out of bounds. But the bottom line is Ted Kennedy, to his credit, and not to his credit the choices he made around Chappaquiddick, but to his credit after that, he chose to become one of the best senators working in a bipartisan way in the United States Senate. So in his later campaigns, that didn't come up again in any serious way, or someone might have tried it, but his record overtook the scandal around Chappaquiddick. The way it's working today, and it's part a lot because of 24/7 media, a lot because of social media, if that same thing were to happen to another person today, they would not make it through, even if they were somehow related to one of the iconic families in the United States. So the particular both unfortunate choices that Ted Kennedy made at the time, but the following choices that he made and had ended up with a stellar career, if that were to happen to someone today, they wouldn't have a chance.
Next, a look at history and its parallels to the present day. Kenneth Morris is the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass and the great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. He and his mother co-founded the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives to help educate young people about modern-day slavery and its parallels to history. He was in Rochester to launch a new project that will distribute millions of copies of Douglass's life story to young people across the country, and that includes thousands of books here in Rochester. He joined us in studio to talk about how he is carrying on the legacy of his ancestors. And in this clip, he starts by explaining how these two iconic families became related.
It was on my mother's side of the family. My grandfather, Frederick Douglass III, is Frederick Douglass's great-grandson. And my grandmother, Nettie Hancock Washington, is Booker T. Washington's granddaughter. They met in 1941 at Tuskegee Institute, which is a school that Booker T. Washington founded in 1881. They happened to be on campus the same day. They were rushing across to get to the other side, literally bumped into each other, and didn't know that the other descended from an historic family, and they fell in love at first sight and wound up getting married 3 months later.
Come on.
It's a true love story.
Isn't that amazing?
Now, as a father of two daughters, I don't recommend getting married 3 months after meeting somebody for the first time, but that's what happened.
Amazing. And I've seen in a number of your speeches that you made, and I know you travel the country, you talk about, who was it, your great-grandmother, Fanny? Talked about, you know, kind of sitting on her knee, and she's telling you the story of the great man with big white hair.
Fanny Douglass, my great-grandmother, lived to be 103 years old, and she met Frederick Douglass when she was a little girl in Atlanta. She was about 8 years old, and she didn't know that she would grow up and marry his grandson, Joseph. But that's what happened, and I spent all of my summers in Frederick Douglass's summer beach house in Highland Beach, Maryland, which is on the shores of the Chesapeake Bay. And at the top of the house, it was built for Frederick to retire in. And at the top of the house was a space called the Tower. And he wanted to sit there at the end of his life and look back across the Chesapeake Bay. And on the other side, you can see land. And that land is the eastern shore of Maryland, where he was born into slavery and where he toiled away in chains. And in that house, my great-grandmother would sit me on her knee in that tower and look back across the water and describe his life to me, but also meeting him for the first time. And she used to call him the man with the great big white hair, and she did so until she passed away.
So for you, you know, with the title of great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass, you still could touch human hands that touched Frederick Douglass, and I know that that mattered to you.
We spend a lot of time in schools talking to elementary age school children and secondary school children. And when I introduce myself as the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass and the great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, and that's a whole lot of greats even to try and say. And they're always looking at me just really with this look on their face like, wow, you are so far removed. And so when I start with a story of my great-grandmother Fanny Douglass and my Aunt Portia, who was Booker T. Washington's daughter, and she lived to be 95. And one day I was trying to wrap my mind around the distance between the generations, and I did have this thought that hands that actually touched the great Frederick Douglass and hands that touched the great Booker T. Washington also touched mine. So in a sense, even with all of those greats, I can say I stand just one person away from each man. I stand one person away from history, and I stand one person away from slavery.
And yet when you were growing up, and don't let me tell the story, let's back it up and let's talk about the weight of knowing that you're growing up with those family legacies and how it impacted you.
Also in that beach house, there were photographs of my ancestors everywhere. And those of us that are familiar with the pictures of Frederick Douglass, he looks very serious and stern. And as a little boy, there was a portrait that was larger than life that hung at the top of the stairs. And I remember thinking, looking at him, man, you look mean. And I'm glad that I didn't know you. This is what I'm thinking as a five-year-old boy. And as I would try and sneak past the portrait, his eyes would follow me. And I always imagined in my little boy imagination this booming baritone voice bellowing down on me, "You will do great things, young man." And it was like it was reverberating off the walls of a 19th century abolitionist meeting house. And then I started to notice that my ancestors were on statues, they're on money, stamps, bridges are named for them, schools are named for them. And it seemed that everywhere I turned, I was really in a long, vast shadow. And then the few times that I told people of my relationship when I was younger, nobody ever believed me, and I never thought it was a point worth arguing. So I did early on begin to start to feel that weight of expectation.
Did you kind of, is that fair to say, did you hide from it in any way at that point, or did you decide, I'm going to carve out my own life, I'm not going to use this legacy, I'm not going to rely on it? Did you try not to think about it? How did you kind of think about your context and your place in history?
There was quite a bit that went into it. I had seen what the pressure had done to those that came before me. My grandfather and my grandmother, I told you about the happy love story, but there's also a tragic side to the story, and that is my grandfather, who was the namesake of one of this country's greatest heroes. My grandfather was a brilliant man. He was a surgeon, and the reason that he was down in Tuskegee on that fateful day that they met was because he had been commissioned down there by the Veterans Administration during World War II. And he always walked around with this weight on his shoulders, and people expected him to be an iconic leader like his great-grandfather. And when my grandmother was 3 months pregnant with my mom, that weight became too much for him to carry, and he took his own life. And so when I was born, my parents and grandparents and my great-grandmothers went in the complete opposite direction, and they weren't going to force anything on me. So I really grew up, as I say, when I speak to students, decisively disengaged from this lineage for most of my life.
First of all, I'm certainly very sorry about that, and I can't relate to the pressure that a family would feel, but sometimes it's easy to assume that it is easy for people who come from great names and lineages because of perceived advantages that may be there. So I'm certainly sorry to hear that. And we've read the story of what happened with that Nat Geo headline. 2005, a friend passes the magazine to you with a cover story about 21st century slavery. Take me through your reaction and what that did to you.
Yeah, that friend's name is Robert Benz, and he also is a co-founder of our organization, so we still work together. I met him in the advertising and marketing world. he and Joe Esposito also had their own business, so we shared the same business partner. But Robert, when he found out about this legacy and this heritage that I carried, you know, he thought it would be a great idea to do something with it. And we were really at the point in our lives and our careers where we felt like we had been given so much and we were looking to give back. And he read the article. It was a 2003 article, but he gave it to me in 2005. And when I read it, the headline was 21st Century Slaves. And it was about modern day slavery and what's called human trafficking. And this idea that slavery still exists in every country around the world, including right here in the United States. And then I did further research. And in the introduction, you mentioned my daughters. And I remember reading an article about a 12-year-old girl who was a sex slave in the brothels of Southeast Asia, and she was forced to service multiple men per day. And it was nighttime when I was reading that article, and down the hallway I could hear my girls getting ready for bed, and they were laughing and just having a good time. And I couldn't wrap my mind around what I was reading about this 12-year-old sex slave and what I was hearing. And I was thinking to myself, down the hallway, that's what young girls and boys should be doing, is getting tucked safely into their bed and not being forced into bed to service some sick individual. And when I put the magazine down and I walked in to say goodnight to my girls, I had this moment where I didn't even feel that I could look them in the eyes and look them in the eyes and walk away and not do something about this issue. And I started to think about this idea that my ancestors, I had this platform that my ancestors had built through struggle and through sacrifice. And if we could leverage the historical significance of my ancestry, we could do something about this. And so we looked at Booker T. Washington's legacy of being the great educator and Frederick Douglass's legacy of being the great abolitionist. We combined it, abolition through education, and we would go and work on this issue from a preventative standpoint to bring knowledge into the classroom.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks, as always, for listening throughout the week and to this podcast. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you Monday.